I want you to picture a steel artery, okay? It's stretching for thousands of miles, maybe buried under the permafrost in Alaska or running along the seabed of the Atlantic. Inside this artery, you've got oil or natural gas flowing at pressures that are, well, they're hard to even comprehend. We're talking in excess of 100 megapascals.
And just to put that number in perspective, 100 megapascals is, it's roughly 1,000 times the atmospheric pressure pressing down on you right now. It is a terrifying amount of contained energy.
Right. And if that steel artery fails, it's not just a flat tire. It's an environmental catastrophe. It's billions of dollars in damage. So the question that keeps engineers up at night isn't just how do we build this? It's how do we make sure these massive steel structures don't just burst?
It's a huge engineering challenge. I mean, you're asking these materials to hold that pressure while enduring shifting ground, temperature swings from Arctic cold to desert heat, corrosion. But the really scary part, the weak point usually isn't the pipe
It's
itself.
the joints.
It's the welds. That's the battlefield. If a pipeline fails, 9 times out of 10, you look at the joints first.
And that brings us right to the stack of research we're digging into today. We have a PhD thesis here from the University of Cambridge, written by Nilabro Madhav Bhattacharya.
It's a bit of a mouthful, the title.
It is, yeah. The effects of niobium in the heat-affected zone of microalloyed steel.
It sounds incredibly dense, I know, but if you strip away the academic jargon, it's basically a detective story. We're looking at a villain, a specific weak spot in the metal called the heat-affected zone,
Okay.
and a potential hero, a chemical element called niobium.
A hero and a villain in a microscopic war. I love it. Okay, let's unpack this.
To understand the war, you kind of have to understand the terrain. The oil and gas market is brutal. They need longer pipelines to get to remote resources, and they need to push that gas through at higher pressures to make it efficient.
Which means you need stronger steel. Because if the steel is weak, you have to make the pipe walls incredibly thick to hold the pressure, right? Like you're building a tank.
You could do that, sure, but thick walls are just so expensive. They're heavy to transport, they take forever to weld. The material costs just go through the roof.
Oh.
So the industry pushed for a whole new class of material. They call them high strength, low alloy steels. And the star of this thesis is a specific grade called X80.
X80. Okay, so I'm trying to remember my high school chemistry here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but to make steel harder, you add carbon. That's the classic recipe, right? Iron plus carbon equals steel. So is X80 just packed with carbon?
See, that's the logical assumption. And historically, yeah, carbon was the answer, but carbon is a real double-edged sword. If you add too much, say over 0.4% by weight, the steel gets incredibly strong, sure, but it loses toughness.
Toughness, you mean it gets brittle, like glass.
Exactly like glass, it can take a static load, but if you hit it shatters. And the even bigger problem for pipelines is weldability. High carbon steel is a nightmare to weld.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when you heat it up and cool it down, it just loves to crack. It's called hydrogen cracking.
And cracking during welding seems like a total non-starter for a pipeline that needs, what, thousands of perfect welds.
It's an absolute deal breaker. You just can't have cracks. So modern metallurgy had to find a workaround. They dropped the carbon way, way down. The X80 steel in this study has extremely low carbon, like 0.05%.
Wow, that's barely any carbon at all. It's almost pure iron. So how on earth do they get the strength back?
And that is where microalloying comes in. They add tiny, just trace amounts of other elements to do the heavy lifting that carbon used to do, and the heavyweight champion of those elements,
Let me guess, niobium.
niobium.
So niobium is the secret sauce, but here's the paradox I found in the reading. You make this high-tech, low-carbon steel in a factory. The source calls it thermomechanically controlled processing.
TMCP. You can think of it like a gym workout for the metal. They roll it, they squash it, they cool it under very, very strict temperature controls in the factory.
So it leaves the factory as this masterpiece of engineering.
It's perfect. The crystal structure is perfectly aligned.
Right, but then to build the pipeline, you have to weld it out in the field, which means you take a blowtorch or an electric arc and you blast that masterpiece with intense heat.
You're essentially just hitting the undo button on all that careful factory processing.
That's terrifying. You spend all this money engineering the steel to be perfect, and then the mere act of assembling it just destroys the engineering.
Locally, yeah. That heat, it radiates out from the weld pool and it just cooks the surrounding metal. And that cooked region is what we call the heat affected zone, or HAZ.
Hence the villain of our story.
And this is where the whole scientific controversy starts. The thesis points out that for years, researchers have been arguing about niobium's role right in this specific zone.
Okay.
Some say niobium in the heat-affected zone destroys toughness. It makes the pipe brittle right next to the weld. Others are saying, no, no, if you add enough of it, it actually saves the toughness.
So does the hero save the day, or does he accidentally blow up the building?
That is the billion-dollar question.
Yeah.
And to answer it, we have to look at what niobium is actually doing down at the atomic level.
Okay, give me the niobium 101. I know it's a metal, but what's it doing inside that crystal lattice?
All right, so imagine the steel is made of grains, like a mosaic or a honeycomb. Generally speaking, small grains are good. Small grains make steel strong and tough. You want a really fine mesh.
Small grains good, big grains bad. Got it.
But thermodynamics is always working against you. At high temperatures, like when you're welding, those grains want to grow. They want to cannibalize each other and just balloon up to lower their energy state.
Mm.
And this happens when the steel is in a high temperature phase called austenite.
So the heat turns the steel into this austenite phase, and the grains start expanding like balloons.
Unless you stop them. And this is where niobium comes in. Niobium bonds with carbon and nitrogen to form these tiny, tiny particles. They're called precipitates. Think of them like microscopic rocks or pins.
Pins. Okay, I like that.
These precipitates, they sit right on the boundaries of the grains. So when a grain boundary tries to expand, it literally hits the pin.
It gets snagged.
Exactly. The pin exerts a drag force. It anchors the boundary in place.
So it's physically holding the walls of the grain together.
We call this Zener pinning. It's a crucial concept. If you have enough of these niobium pins, and they are the right size, they lock the grain structure in place. Even when the heat from the weld is trying to blow them up, the pins say, nope, you stay small.
So niobium is the anchor.
It is. And the reason we use niobium and titanium instead of, say, chromium, is that niobium carbides are incredibly stable. They can survive heat up to 1,200, even 1,300 degrees Celsius without just melting away.
But the source makes a really big distinction here that I want to drill down on. It talks about precipitated niobium versus solute niobium. And I got the sense this distinction is the key to the whole mystery.
It is the smoking gun. Think of it like sugar in hot tea.
Okay, I'm with you.
If you stir the sugar and it dissolves completely, it's in solution. That's solute niobium. If you dump in way too much sugar and it just sits as a pile of sludge at the bottom, that's the precipitate.
So dissolved atoms versus solid particles.
Exactly. And they do completely different things. Solute niobium, the dissolved stuff, it changes the hardenability. It affects the timing of how the steel transforms as it cools down.
It plays with the clock.
Yes. It delays the transformation. On the other hand, precipitated niobium, the solid pins, that strengthens the material by physically blocking movement within the crystal. That's known as the Orowan mechanism.
Whoa, hang on. I want to make sure I have this straight. Zener pinning keeps the grain small.
Mm-hmm.
Orowan mechanism makes the material strong. And both of these depend on the niobium being a solid particle.
You nailed it. If the niobium is solid, it pins grains and it blocks dislocations. If it's dissolved, it just messes with the cooling chemistry.
Okay, I see the board. Now let's introduce the chaos. Mm-hmm. We're welding. You have heat spiking, metal melting, and then it's cooling really fast. The niobium is probably constantly switching between being a solid pin and dissolving.
That's the dynamic. And if you get that balance wrong, you get a brittle pipe.
Let's look at the map of the weld then. The thesis focuses on a very specific slice of the metal. The source calls it the CGHAZ.
The coarse-grained heat-affected zone.
Right.
This is the danger zone. When you weld, the metal right in the middle melts. That's the fusion zone. But right next to it, there's a sliver of steel that gets incredibly hot, maybe 1,350, 1,400 degrees, but it doesn't quite melt.
And that's the CGHAZ.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because it gets so hot, the risk is that those niobium pins we talked about, well, they might dissolve.
Even though you said they were stable.
They're stable up to a point, but 1,400 degrees is incredibly hot. And if they dissolve, the pins are gone, the Zener pinning fails, the grains just explode in size. And suddenly, right next to your perfect weld, you have this band of giant coarse grains.
And giant grains mean brittle metal. It's the Achilles heel.
That is where the crack will start. So the conflict in the scientific literature was basically about this region. Some researchers saw brittle behavior, and they blamed the niobium. They thought the dissolved niobium was promoting bad microstructures like martensite.
And others disagreed. So how did Padacharya solve this? Because the thesis mentions they didn't just go out and weld 100 pipes. That seems expensive.
And really imprecise. Welding is messy, you know. You have variable voltage, travel speed, cooling rates. It's hard to isolate one variable. So what the author did was use a simulation.
They baked the steel.
Essentially, yeah. They took small samples of this X80 steel and subjected them to very precise heat treatments that mimic the thermal shock of welding.
I saw that table in the source. These recipes like 950Q and 1230Q.
Right. So they'd heat samples to 950 degrees C, 1100 C, 1230 C, and then quench them, cool them instantly. This let them freeze the niobium in different states. At 950, most of the pins are still there. At 1230, you forced almost everything to dissolve into solution.
So they created these little avatars of the different scenarios that might happen inside a real weld.
Correct. But then comes the really clever part. How do you measure the results? Normally, a metallurgist would use a transmission electron microscope or a TEM.
Which sounds high-tech enough to do the job.
It is powerful, but it has a massive blind spot. A TEM looks at a tiny, tiny slice of material. You might be looking at a field of view that is only a few hundred nanometers wide.
So you're only counting maybe 10 or 20 precipitates.
It's anecdotal evidence, basically. It's like trying to judge the health of an entire forest by looking at three leaves. It's just not statistically significant.
Right.
So Padacharya used a technique called SXS, small angle X-ray scattering.
That sounds like a weapon from Star Trek. What does SXX do that the microscope doesn't?
You shine a high-power X-ray beam through a bulk sample of the steel, a much larger chunk. The X-rays hit the electrons in the material and they scatter. And the angle at which they bounce off tells you the size of the particles they hit.
So instead of seeing 20 particles, you're getting data from, what, millions?
Billions, potentially. You get a statistical average of the entire volume. It lets you quantify exactly how much niobium is precipitated and, crucially, what the size distribution looks like. And this was a totally novel approach for this specific problem.
Okay, so they have the samples. They had the X-ray vision. Let's talk about what they found. The literature review mentions this cast of characters, different crystal structures that form as the steel cools.
Mm.
We already met austenite, the hot one. Who else is in the mix?
Well, when austenite cools, it has to transform into something else. The good guy for X80 steel is usually bainite. It's a structure of really fine plates. It's strong and it's tough.
Bainite is the goal. Who's the villain?
Martensite. In this context, at least, martensite forms when you cool the steel too fast or the chemistry is off. It's very, very hard, but it's brittle. The thesis specifically warns about MA islands, martensite austenite islands.
Islands of brittleness in a sea of steel.
That's it, exactly. They act like pre-existing cracks. If the pipeline is stressed, the fracture starts right at the MA island.
And there's one more character mentioned, acicular ferrite.
Ah, acicular ferrite. This is the good guy. Inside the weld metal itself, it forms these chaotic interlocking needles. Because the structure is so chaotic, if a crack tries to push through, it just gets deflected. It can't run in a straight line.
It's a maze that traps the crack.
Exactly. So the goal is get bainite and acicular ferrite, avoid martensite, and avoid those giant grains.
So here's where it gets really interesting. What do the X-rays reveal? Does niobium help or hurt?
The study found that it's not really about the amount of niobium, it's about the size entropy.
Size entropy, that sounds like a physics term.
It just means you need a diversity of sizes. The thesis showed that the best performance came when there was a bimodal distribution, meaning two peaks in the size chart.
You want some big ones and some small ones, why?
Okay, so you need the coarse precipitates, the big chunks. These are the ones large enough to survive that 1350 degree heat in the CGHAZ. They don't fully dissolve.
They stay behind and pin the austenite grain boundaries.
Right, they hold the line against the grain growth that handles the zener pinning, but you also need the fine precipitates.
Yeah.
In the hottest zones, these little ones do dissolve.
But wait, earlier we said dissolving was risky because it changes the chemistry.
It is risky, but if you control it, it's beneficial. When they dissolve, they put niobium back into the solution. As the metal cools, that dissolved niobium suppresses the formation of soft, weak ferrite and encourages the formation of that tough bainite we want.
Oh, I see. It's a complete balancing act. So if you have only big rocks, you pin the grains, but you don't get the chemical benefits during cooling.
Right. And if you have only small dust, it all dissolves way too early. The grains grow huge because the pins are gone and you get a brittle pipe.
That is incredibly nuanced. It really is a detective story.
And it explains why the previous researchers were fighting. The ones who said niobium was bad probably had steel where the particles were too fine, everything dissolved, the grains grew, they got brittle martensite.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who said it was good likely had a distribution that allowed for pinning to still happen.
So Bhattacharya proved that the history of the steel matters.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just look at the chemical composition sheet and say 0.05% niobium,
right.
We're good. You have to ask, how big are the particles before I even start welding?
Correct. The dirt in the steel, which is what precipitates essentially are, acts as the structural reinforcement, but only if that dirt is the right size.
So what does this all mean? Why should you care about nanoparticle sizes?
It all comes back to predictability. We are pushing for higher and higher pressures. X80 is becoming the standard. This research allows metallurgists to design the steel's processing history specifically to handle the thermal shock of welding.
It turns welding from across your fingers art into a hard science.
It means we can use these advanced steels without the fear that the HAZ is some hidden time bomb. We can actually tune the niobium precipitates in the factory so they react perfectly when the welder touches the torch to the pipe out in the field.
It connects the rolling mill to the construction site. That's actually really cool.
It really highlights that material science isn't just about making things stronger. It's about understanding the fourth dimension, time. The history of the material, how it was processed, heated, cooled, it dictates its entire future.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought from the very front of this thesis. It's not something you usually see in a heavy engineering paper. The author included a quote from the book, Three Men in a Boat.
I saw that. It was about idleness, wasn't it?
Yeah. The quote is, "It is impossible to enjoy idling thoroughly unless one has plenty of work to do."
It's a great quote about human nature, but yeah, surprisingly relevant to steel.
That's what I was thinking. Metal is the same way. If the steel is just idling, if it's just pure relaxed iron, it's actually pretty weak. It's soft.
True. It needs stress to be strong.
It needs those precipitates. Pinning the grains, blocking the dislocations, constantly struggling against the forces of heat and stress. It's the internal conflict, the work, that gives the material its integrity.
That is a poetic way to look at dislocation theory. The internal friction is what holds the world up.
So next time you think about a pipeline, don't just think of a dumb metal tube. Think of the billions of tiny niobium anchors working overtime, holding the line against the heat, keeping the whole thing from bursting.
And the researchers like Dr. Bhattacharya who figured out how to make them all work together.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the microscopic battleground of pipeline steel.
Always a pleasure.
We'll catch you on the next one.